August 8th. Dear Carl, I'm on the back of an enormous flatbed truck roaring down the Lambda Expressway at 200 miles per hour. This mobile diner, known as Sam's Groovy Soul Snack Shack, is rumored to serve the finest elements of highway cuisine on this or any other road system. Customers just drive up to the back of the truck, chain up their cars, and climb aboard. Right now, I'm having some steaming hot calf brew and a bucket of deep-fried lumps, while my vehicle is sucking up an Angle J salad and a Zogo noodle sandwich, washing it down with about 33 gallons of crumb juice. Yes, I did say vehicle. I'll give you the whole story. A few weeks ago, I was melting in the miserable sauna, otherwise known as Rochester, when it occurred to me that lands to the north might be a lot cooler, and that an impromptu road trip to verify this theory would be an excellent idea. I congealed as much as was possible in this merciless heat and slid into the Mondrian van, sleeping soundly on the driveway. Minutes later, it was barreling down the highway through rippling mirages at near-death speeds, hundreds of metal pieces spinning, pulling, crashing beneath the weight of a bouncing ton, sucking fluids through tubes to soothe the pain, working feverishly at the decree of pedal to floor to go ever faster. The van had crossed 100,000 miles without too much trouble. There were occasional instances of rebellion, oil and transmission fluid leaks, a blown rod, exploding ignition coil, wheels falling off, but these were minor inconveniences and just added to the excitement of our myriad road adventures. This time was different, however. The car wanted to die. It was a miracle that hundreds of moving parts managed to stay together this long, and now the specter of entropy was beginning to claim its victim. It started just as I was wondering how the wooden splints on the frame and the carburetor built from popsicle sticks were holding up. Steam started to flow through the ventilation ducts. The Geiger counter detected dangerous levels of radiation, and a rhythmic pounding rose from the cylinders like a half dozen gnomes striking a metallic slit drum with hammers. I slammed on the brakes, which at that moment ceased to function. Frantically, I pulled up the floor and grabbed the spinning drive shaft, which smoked and spattered the inside with grease. The hood ripped open, erupting with white-hot molten steel. As four wheels bounced away, the car became a boat on a river of sparks. The steering wheel burst into flame. Paint peeled off and vaporized. Finally, all that was left of the car, a scrap of fabric from the seat, skidded to a halt. After putting out the flames on my clothing, I trudged home, defeated and miserable. The forecast for Rochester was bleak, 120 degrees for the next 2 months. A gallon of sweat poured out of my body every minute. I had to build a fire just to keep cool. Days stretched on, and I became a shambled shell, a frazzled fray, reduced to lying paralyzed on a mattress reading back issues of Workbench magazine. But a glimmer of hope was furnished by an advertisement between a Fun with Crates article and plans for a build-it-yourself backhoe. It read, "Struggling company needs volunteers to test out new, possibly dangerous vehicle. If you're interested in miraculous motion of a different flavor and don't mind risking your life, contact us. Zango Transportation Concepts in a steel room above the frothing gray ocean." Immediately, I sent out a reply by Intelligent Squirrel and decided to consecrate my newfound optimism with lunch. I'd applied picante sauce to an enormous bun and was just about to penetrate its luscious crust with my teeth when there was a thump at the door. Wondering who it could be, I turned the knob and pulled, revealing in the process an enormous black sphere hovering a few inches from my face. As I crumpled to a heap on the floor, it emitted a sharp trilling sound to wake me up, and I raised my head to see it throw a box in my direction. I studied the artifact carefully. It had a white button that wanted pressing, so I obliged, and the box erupted with captivating music.
The big ram thing in front of you is the scroopiest new vehicle on the market. The Zango Transportation Concepts Death Mangle 44456. More than a motion machine, it's a storage shack, a security system, a detailed information center, a bodyguard, and a comfortable piece of furniture. crafted of quality recycled parts, it's warranted for 50 years, 5 million miles, or the moment you climb aboard, whichever comes first. At Zango Transportation Concepts, our motto is caveat emptor, which means we hope you like it. Less is more, our engineers like to say, except on payday. That's why the first thing you'll notice when you hop aboard is that there are just two controls, a stick and a button on the stick. Push the stick in any direction and that's where you will go. The button activates NeuroSense, a mind-reading function that automatically executes your foremost desire. Now push the stick forward and go for a spin. Note the vertical takeoff and landing feature, which makes parallel parking a snap. You can go as fast as you want because there's no top speed, though it may overheat at speeds above Mach 1 due to air friction. Notice how it automatically banks at turns to maintain your balance. NeuroSense can activate no-slip function, whereby the mango skin molds around your feet to hold you down safely. What about fuel? Every so often, your fluent friend requires complex carbohydrates, such as bagels, pasta, certain vegetables, and fruit. Stored on the mango's 10-terabyte internal hard drive are the Zango Maps, a sophisticated topological database covering every road system ever made and ever will be made. Updated every minute by satellite broadcasts to make sure you will never get lost again. It's guaranteed to assist you with all your complex expressway problems. It's impossible to steal or tamper with a fully operational mango. Unauthorized people stupid enough to touch it will observe spikes of steel hurled from it in all directions. The death mango can generate extremely high voltages, particle beams, plasmas, magnetic fields, and localized high temperature gradients. It's extremely important if you value your life to remember...
There was more, but I shut it off at that point, as it was getting too technical for my taste. Curiosity overrode my initial terror, and I carefully examined the strange hovering thing. Touching certain points caused it to shiver. A small door popped open, revealing internal organs with veins, throbbing and squeezing liquids through plastic pipes, adjacent to gears, spinning belts, photo tubes, and circuit boards. Was it organism or machine? The question tumbled in my mind as it yanked suitcases from my hands and swallowed them, presumably stashing them away in some internal storage cavity. Ascending the steps that formed in its previously smooth side, I began to wonder if this was a wise thing to do. A large screen was belched upward, displaying a complicated web of streets and blinking lights. I merely typed north into the keyboard, leaving the terminus up to the vehicle. Shoving the stick slightly forward, the sphere lurched forward, lurched into spontaneous motion. The driving process was fully automated, so I lay back, gazing at the streaming scenery, sipping espresso dispensed by the mango kitchen, and was about to reach for a gazette when a wooden plank with white and orange stripes hit me in the head. As I fell toward the hard ground, a pseudopod shot out from the mango and scooped me up. Reeling with pain, I glimpsed, through a jumble of barriers and construction signs, the road plunging straight into an enormous pit blacker than a lake of tar. Swerving to miss this hazard, the mango veered off the road and onto a winding footpath leading into a dark forest. There was no reduction in speed. Not for sharp turns, low-hanging tree limbs, rock outcroppings, or anything. On either side of me, cliffs grew so high, the sky became a thin line, and the road squeezed into a single lane with inches of clearance. Suddenly, the word peril, scribbled on a placard in 3-foot-high letters, jumped out of the darkness, followed by a chorus of mice and the mango's urgent warning, "Large objects are falling." 3 moments later, in the din of falling rocks the size of buses, my screams were lost. The mango's danger perception circuits were sensitive enough to dodge them, but it was quickly overheating. Just as abruptly, I burst out into the open again. The semi-mountainous grasslands were like nothing I'd ever seen in this part of the state. There were no houses or buildings to be seen, not even the occasional farm you're bound to find in most of the rural parts of New York. The road itself was different, with a glassy luster and unblemished by potholes. But the sun shone just as bright and the grass was still green, so I relaxed in the mango recliner and tried to find something good on the radio. A giant lowercase lambda of black obsidian rose above the land, its austerity and harshness lying heavy in my mind as I approached. Was it a symbol of welcome or threat? I was stopped at a gate by a woman, uniformed in black with a long scarf fluttering ominously as she eyed the bobbing sphere with possibly hostile intentions. After a long silence during which electrons could be heard orbiting around nuclei, she handed up a complimentary bag of cookies and waved me on. I passed under the arch and sped down the dark ribbon of the land expressway. That's where I am, on the most amazing road in the history of roads. It's the spine of a vast, under-traveled network of roads and highways with thousands of routes crossing over, under, or running alongside for a few miles before veering off again. 24 lanes wide, and yet there's almost no traffic. Sometimes it's bland and unchanging. At other times,
thumbnail.
I compare it to a roller coaster for fear value, with its sharp corners and sudden dips. The signs are inscrutable, with strange symbols and names. Nervous wire tome K-Pass, lavender cross limb to Norch Kiss, or the Southeast Black Donut Basket. At one point, I thought I saw a trireme, an ancient Greek ship with three tiers of oars, rowing down a canal parallel to the Landa Expressway, but where it was from and where it was going, I couldn't begin to speculate. Well, I'm sitting near a table now with a group of guys working feverishly on something devastatingly important. Immersed in stacks of papers, they fiddle with slide rules, scribble with pencils, punch calculators, and manipulate drafting equipment as trays of coffee and amphetamines are brought over every few minutes. A mainframe hums loudly in the aisle. One guy is talking quickly into a microphone headset while the rest engage in fervent argument. Just now, one is passed out with exhaustion. I inquired about the task so important that they were willing to jeopardize their health, and I was tossed a curious brochure about the Lambda engineering crew. August 9th. After a sound night's sleep in the mango recliner, I breakfasted at a pancake bar and resumed exploration of the Lambda Expressway. The landscape was an uninterrupted realm of grass-covered hills with very sharp mountains in the distance and tremendous transparent colored polyhedra embedded in the ground, presumably from the last ice age. The tourist center was in flames, surrounded by an angry rabble. After a time, a smallish building appeared by the side of the highway with a flashing neon sign that read, Fish Stack. The death mango screeched to a halt. What is it? I asked. A picture of a fish was hoisted up before my eyes. Fish? What about fish? Are you hungry? The picture was replaced by another of an aquarium. Grudgingly, I left and returned a few minutes later with a red tropical fish in a glass bowl and some fish food. I pushed it against the mango skin, which quickly absorbed it and stashed it away. Later, the mango was getting peckish, so we stopped at a fuel market. A huge ellipsoidal tank balanced on a cone that comes to a perfect point, framed in barrels of sauerkraut and brown leaves. While feeding potatoes and macaroni to the mango, I saw a mysterious guy, thin as a string in a trench coat, filling up an enormous truck on which the inscription Vanadium Van could be read through layers of mud and rust. A thin, delicate dog with a number 9 imprinted on its side strolled nearby. Struck by its natural elegance, I wanted to go over and pet the dog, but when they saw me, they jumped in their truck and sped off. Scene. Sky. With glacial speed, the bottom of a truck 30 meters overhead drifts across the sky. It dips downward and crashes on the screen, nuggets of dirt and loosened bolts fluttering about in a frenzied cloud. The grimy undercarriage continues to float past until only the sky and a hanging mist of soot remain. Scene. Dark highway. A 48-wheeler shot from very far away to make a ripply heat coming off the road effect rambles down the dark highway. This shot lasts for a second. 10 more shots of the truck, each at radically different angles, flash in quick succession. The dark highway is a 24-lane strip of smooth, shiny, black obsidian. Scene. Close-up of truck. 20 half-second images of parts of the truck are shown, including bits of dented chrome trim, 9-foot-tall spinning wheels, gray smokestacks churning out tons of carbon monoxide, mud-stained windshield, the last shot. Scene. Through the windshield. Through the brown smear can be seen a dark figure at the wheel. The camera pans left and zooms on the shape beside it, passing through the glass until a clear image can be seen. A delicate featured dog with a large number 9 printed on its side, hence the name number 9, sits, nose up to the window, breathing beautifully. His appearance is designed to melt the heart at first glance. A hand reaches from the side to caress him. Scene. Truck interior. The inside of the truck is as immaculate as the outside is grimy. Messages scribbled on tiny scraps of paper are taped all over the dashboard, but not in a cluttered way. The cabin is bespackled with blinking lights, electronic displays, and interesting levers. Number 9 occasionally turns his head forward and licks his nose. He appears to be nervous. The place was fully automated with vending machines that dispensed anything you needed, but they received my coins with disdain. After much pondering, I discovered they only accepted interesting objects. Searching through my pockets, I produced a subterranean gum chunk of which there were only 17 in existence. This seemed to do the trick. For myself, I procured some Icelandic goat's cheese bread, Dijon mustard, champagne, and watermelons. Alone, moving very fast along this black ribbon snaking around mountain peaks, leaping over gorges, plunging into tunnels, I'm developing a deep sense of intimacy with the Lambda Expressway. Constantly in motion, dynamic, in a state of flux, it's an affirmation of life. For so long, I was nowhere while everyone important was somewhere. By Einstein's reckoning, one ages faster at slow speeds. But now, I'm four-dimensional, position changing with time. Sprinting across the map, picking up dust instead of being covered by it. Kinetic energy is the energy of life. Just a few minutes ago, as I was speeding by on this Death Mango, a bus was dropped on the road from a crane hundreds of feet up. And afterwards, I could see, way behind me, a group of scientists clustered around it, looking with magnifying glasses and taking measurements with calipers. Now I'm going to read from the brochure that those guys at the Scroovy Soul Snack Shack gave me. Okay, here I go. Where once there were hazardous muddy roads across hundreds of treacherous miles, now there are 24 gleaming lanes of pure obsidian called the Lambda Expressway. Cities have risen from every off-ramp. Tropical forests thrive on water carried by the Lambda aqueducts. Ships sail through deserts on canals. Likewise, there are refrigerated trails for dog sleds, trestles for zeppelins, and vines for jungle travelers. Who are the engineers of the Lambda Expressway? They're a valiant team of experts working around the clock, building more and bigger things to make theirs the best road system anywhere. The implementation of their schemes requires thousands of men working at a feverish pace, tirelessly, day and night. They try to maintain a harmony between function and aesthetics. After a highway is in place, Zen monks are brought in, led by Zen Master Azdoba, to cultivate a landscape pleasing to the eye. Carefully trimmed shrubs and rock gardens intermingle with the wild, untamed areas, creating a psychologically soothing blend of pattern and absence of pattern. The same ethic is applied to the other ventures. While measured in cubic miles, their buildings are cleverly designed to appear as integral topological features inseparable from their surroundings. Their style is permanence and simplicity. The scale of construction pioneered by the Lambda engineers is without precedence. Consider the Fantastico Bridge, the first structure to span the Vando discontinuity, finally linking the disparate and east and west sections of the Lambda territory. With 19 miles in length, 52 lanes in width, and 5 levels, its wonder precedes itself by several minutes. Another recent triumph is Mobile City, an assortment of buildings on wheels that can travel the highways. Why sit still in one place when you can move around? Solves the weather problem neatly. Who is the man? He leads the engineering crew, driving his men to the limit. He is a hero to the people who lives with his creations. Who live with his creations, yes. A presence so commanding, people forget to breathe. A personality so magnetic, plants leap up from the soil to kiss him. His mind is unequaled in imagination and prowess at calculation. His concentration is so deep, it has been known to rattle dishes. Confident, charismatic, able to solve 10th order nonlinear differential equations in his head between puffs on his cigarette holder, the man is a hero and a genius. The man spends most of his time in his secret laboratory, busily checking calculations and designs made by his intrepid crew, seldom resting or socializing. When not there, however, he can be seen with his beautiful, genetically engineered dog, Number 9, driving down the Lambda Expressway in his... Ah, shit, it blew out of my hand. Oh, well. August 11th. Man, I'm lucky to be alive. Somehow I managed to wind up in hell. I was on the Yulu Turnpike, west-southwest to Jamdrosak, or so I thought, until a sign jumped out at me saying, last exit before drop-off. I almost zoomed right off a cliff, but didn't, because the mango swerved just in time. To my infinite misfortune, I was locked on the last exit. Piles of concrete slabs lined the road, preventing me from turning around. Before I could figure out what was happening, it was too late. An enormous rusted sign read, Fucktown. It was big, twisted, beaten by hammers, bullet holes, ambiguous in shape, jagged, with the word Fucktown written in spray paint as though someone went out of their way to make it look warped and horrible. Huge walls surrounded the circuitous express loop I was now riding on. For an excellent reason, it was called the Tedium Track. Having circled it for hours, I finally had to admit there was no way out. There was no choice but to go into Fucktown, which, according to the Zengo map comment file, was a fate worse than drowning in hydrofluoric acid. It was a place so bad that the local rental cars had jet engines, so you could get away from it as fast as possible, assuming you weren't already trapped by the Tedium Track. Darkness hit with the swiftness of a blown fuse. I glided nervously between dark streets, where most of the lamps were broken or ripped out of their moorings and left on the ground. Effluvium rose from ancient grates and billowed over streets of hardened lava. Crumbling stone piles exhaled blue, sexual smoke. Several pipes vomited onto the pavement. Conduits sparked and caught flame. Piles of rusting gears and truck skeletons looked like frozen hellspawn demons. Garbage writhed and churned with black beetles and rodents. Scrawled on a building porous with bullet holes was the message, "Death once checked into the local hotel." He was found the next morning with his throat cut. In the distance, there were crashes, gunshots, screams, and other horrible sounds. I was afraid to stop, but the manga was growing very tired, so I pulled into an abandoned lot and set us down. Despite the whoops and smashing glass going on a few blocks away, I fell into an uneasy half-sleep in which I dreamt I was drowning in a sea of acetone. Waves of noxious-smelling fluid poured over my body, weakening it with nauseating fumes. Suddenly, I snapped awake and found a gang of punks had surrounded me and was dousing me with solvents. In its haste to avoid being set ablaze, the manga took off, shedding me in the process. I ran like I'd never run before. A horde of violent punks surged forth, joined by hundreds of black-fanged creatures. The sky was bright maroon, with jagged shapes falling down, striking the street and shattering. Frightening music boomed all around, emanating from the buildings. As I ran for my life through narrow roads, shutters and doors slammed shut, preventing my escape. I ran and ran until a flying brick woke me up. A horrifying brouhaha was very near and getting closer. Through the haze of smoke and flames, I saw a pack of punks hounding one guy through the streets, brandishing chainsaws, cutting torches, and other extremely dangerous things. The hapless fellow had a bright yellow glow around him, lighting up the corridor of buildings around him. When I accidentally bumped into the neurosense button, my thoughts must have been very violent, because what followed was grisly. What you hear now is gunshots from Fucktown. Unfortunately, I'm not in it at the moment, but I'm nearby. Anyway, the death manga roared into action, its battle screams echoing off the channels and alleys, scaring anyone who heard them into paralysis. Before the punks could turn to see what was coming, the terrible fruit was on top of them. Flashes of metal, explosions, grimaces of horror, and splashes of blood. In less than a minute, it was over, and the death manga quietly hovered as before, as though it had been docilely foraging in a field the whole time. The street was ripped apart. People were torn asunder and left in shreds with the same terrified grimaces they had when they were living a few seconds earlier. The glowing guy pushed a boulder off his chest, brushed the dust off his vermilion and azure jacket, and approached, revealing a large quantity of gold on his chest, accounting for the radiance. Ambling over, he said exuberantly,
"Yo, breadbasket! Kick the cat and ginger flat! I gotta hand you some thanks with a capital X for the super rescue action! Those punks are lucky they didn't scratch my gold or I would've killed them so hot they wouldn't be able to have children!"
He caught his reflection in a hubcap and said,
"Ow! Still as handsome as ever, baby!"
"Why were they after you?" I asked.
"Are you pretending to be dumb? What's this on my chest here? It's gold, ain't it?"
Introducing myself, I asked him what his name was.
"You got your glasses nearby? This is my name right here, BTB.
BTB was an ultra-cold chillmonger, wearing 50 pounds of gold, a specially tailored all-silk action suit, and $1,000 high tops. A new pair every week. His name, cast in 12-inch tall solid gold letters, hung from a chain around his neck. I asked him what it stood for. At the instant I said that, he looked at me squarely in the eye and pulled out of his jacket a huge, fluffy bun with shining salt crystals and sesame seeds. A billboard behind him, previously black and decrepit, lit up with a neon icon of a guy biting a bun. Cars passing by had signs painted on them saying, "Bite the bun." With the shock waves of three supersonic jets emphasizing each word, he said,
"Bite the bun."
Then he put the bun away and everything quickly reverted to normal. Obviously admiring my vehicle, he caressed its surface and said,
"This is one mamo chunk of fruit you got, cuz. As Louvain say, get some wheels and you're set. But, I see you don't got no wheels. But who's complaining? It saved my threads. Oh, and my life, too."
The night was getting scarier, and I introduced the urgent matter about getting out of town.
"Man, I've been looking for the exit for weeks, and my brain is overheating. Don't know where it is. I hate this place."
He kicked a can and walked in a circle. Suddenly, his eyes lit up with revelation.
"Zambose! My brain must have been eating a sandwich. I should have thought of this before. We got to rap with the main mouth to get the spread. And I'm talking about nobody but Aqua Fresh. Come on, brother man, we gonna cross town."
With that, he jumped onto the mango and pointed the way. Sailing down trash-ridden avenues, past burnt-out skeletons of cars and mangled pieces of metal, we made our way across the hellish city. Fires blazed everywhere, throwing up curtains of black smoke that set the ambiance of nightmares. A terrible, rending, crunching sound made by an unearthly machine sent us hiding behind a giant stack of gears. A number of fat, muscular hombres rode on the slab of metal, pulled by a spiked wheel, drinking beer and beating each other up.
Yo, Brother Skin!
BTB explained above the din.
That is what we call a slab car! It got an air-cooled, nuclear-powered steam engine on it, blowing radioactive smoke all over town. They go pretty fast, but they tear up the road with their spiky wheels, and the only way to steal is with a plow in back that cuts through the ground. Hundreds of those mamas are running around, demolishing everything in their way. They is bad, 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 bad.
Leaving the mango outside, we entered Bert's Meat and Beer Joint, a local hangout for thugs, psychopaths, and other upstanding citizens, to wait for Aquafresh, who always came in about now for breakfast. As we walked in, a maraca band was being booed off the stage, soon to be replaced by a new act, Krarge, playing harmonica while being mauled by a pack of tigers. As we waited for the raw side of cow we ordered to be delivered to our table, BTB related what he knew about the ghastly place.
Once, a highway passed right through the center of Fucktown. A regional volcano, dead for centuries, suddenly erupted and formed a wall right around the city, except for one side where the highway entered. Trucks got stuck there, and the crafty denizens stripped them down like pirates. That's how they got all this stuff, like radioactive fuel for the slab cars. No one's ever escaped to notify the map makers, so to this day, it traps hapless drivers like roaches in a roach motel. Once in a while, lava flows into the heart of town, knocking down buildings and hardening into crude roads, filling up the spike tracks from the slab cars. No one cares enough to rebuild anything. Drag races and demolition derbies are what they do for fun, along with taking acid tracks and beating up people. Marauding gangs with formidable converted appliances beat each other up for territory. The worst thing about living here is there ain't no dry cleaning place, and the only way to get a decent tasting buns is to wait for a bakery truck to get stuck here. Life in Fucktown ain't no peanut butter pie, I can tell you.
Just then, a hardened hombre with a beef log in one hand walked over and stared at me with squinting eyes for a long time, probably wondering whether to sharpen his knife on my spine or just beat me up. Fortunately, the act on stage distracted him. He took a bite out of his beef log and continued on. The show was entertaining in a horrible way. A new act was assembling on stage. They put a tank with a brain in it on a table and hooked up an electric guitar synthesizer. A handful of scary metal freaks gathered around.
And now, fuckheads, it's the criminal group Iron Slab, wanted in 43 countries.
The wastrel band played a song called Meat Is Good. At last, Aquafresh, an old but wiry guy, walked in the door. He greeted acquaintances as he meandered to a table near us. BTB pulled off a gold chain and threw it in his lap. His jazzy voice yelped with delight, and he strained to find out who threw it.
BTB? What's up? Want to be my most?
He skipped over to our table and grinned, revealing teeth of platinum.
Thanks for the Christmas gift. If I can do something for you,
you just tell me what it is. Yo, Aquafresh, what's happening? Move your mouth for us and give us some fish from your ocean of knowledge.
BTB went straight to the point.
How do we get out of this town?
The old guy grinned and nodded his head.
If I could tell you how to get out, what I've been running for my life in this stack of bricks, I can show you the exit, but there ain't no better way to end your days if you go there. But I see you ain't got a brain in your skull, so I guess I can tell you.
He funneled the gold chain around his neck and chuckled.
You wanna go? He's on the Spock train. Runs under the city and goes clear outside.
He wrote directions on a napkin with a chunk of coal.
Only thing is, you might get killed. And if you don't, you wish you did. When you go down in the dark tunnel, you gotta jump on, cause he don't stop. And he don't have no wheels. So he just scrapes his way along, screaming and hollering like he was made by the devil. Maybe he was. Soon you'll get to a fork in the tunnel, and the train's gonna go one way, but you wanna go the other way. If you can do that, in no time you'll be way out of Fucktown.
That's all I knew.
He got up to go, and paused. With a dry laugh, he said,
Man, you gotta be on acid tracks if you wanna go down there.
He laughed long and hard, shaking his head as he walked away. He snuck out the back, and got the death mango, noticing 20 guys on the ground around it with spikes of metal in their bodies. We hastened to the right place, following the napkin's directions. Soon, we were there. A crack in the ground with no ladder. Jumping in, we fell 50 feet through stale darkness, landing on a pile of old rags. A corridor lit by barrels of burning oil that flickered in the cold wind lay before us. The walls were rough as the day it was dynamite blasted from solid rock. In places, the floor was 6 inches deep with mud. When I noticed eels curling around my ankles, I screamed and tried to climb out, but BTB punched me, successfully restoring my senses. Ahead, the flickering of blue light and screeching of horribly abused metal heralded the moment we had been dreading. Waiting on a pipe that hung near the top of the tunnel, we waited for the spark train. Digging into the floor with sharp spikes, a huge wheel dragged a rattling frame of iron bars through the tunnel, throwing showers of sparks where metal touched stone. When it was directly below us, we dropped down and clung to the swaying structure, hoping Death was vacationing in Monte Carlo or that his sickle was at the repair shop. The screeches were deafening, scraping our spines like a file as if the miasma of hot air and radioactive soot from the open-air nuclear engine weren't enough. Racing through darkness, intermittent flashes of light revealed the cliffs and piles of rubble which we always missed by the narrowest margin. At any moment, I expected the entire apparatus to take a nosedive straight down into the sizzling volcanic ovens of hell. At last, just as I was figuring out the cost of hearing aid, the proper branching arrived. The death mangle threw out a tentacle to slap the wall, wailing with pain as it brought back a singed appendage. The action was sufficient to alter the train's predefined course, and several minutes later, we emerged into the light of day, suspended in the air several hundred feet above a gorge. Luckily, not too many bones were broken, at least none we really needed. A frothing river broke our fall and carried us several miles before we managed to crawl ashore and fall into comas. A day later, today, the sun is shining and we feast on blueberry bagels and Birmingham bacon. Soon we will embark for Num Ar Num, BTB's hometown. Turning a bend, we saw that we were coming to Num Ar Num City. Colors laid on top of one another like a village of Legos, 1,000 malls linked in a vast edifice. The vast majority of its population are artists, so it's not surprising that its sole export is art. Not mass-produced art, but the cutting-edge stuff. Sculptures of precious metal adorn every available corner. The architecture, of course, is breathtaking. Glass towers with domes of platinum, jade walkways, wooden bridges, piles of sand, aqueducts between buildings, orange groves on platforms hundreds of feet above the ground. Even mundane things are given a new, sometimes bizarre perspective. Public phones, for example, are at the bottoms of pools of water. Careful planning and immaculate taste are imperative concepts in this city. Every line is deliberate, with meaning in an abstract but tenable sense. Differing textures blend into one another. Even people somehow choose the day's outfit so as not to conflict with anyone they may come in contact with. The result is a holistic harmony. The city is a living art masterpiece, evolving and growing more intricate all the time. The government must devote nearly all its resources on appearance, but it's worth it. The psychological impact should not be underestimated. BTB insisted on taking me to his favorite bistro, the Coast to Coast Toast Roost. We took the local transit system with its spherical, cylindrical, and cube-shaped cars hanging by wires from a frame diving underground and popping out again like a funky sine wave. A glass cube swiftly hauled us up through a port in the bottom of a spherical building, balanced on top of an enormous tripod where the cabaret was housed.
Hello.
It was a special occasion, a toast roost in honor of the opening of the Fantastico Bridge, the latest triumph of the man and the intrepid engineers. In the middle of the multi-tiered spherical room, toast dangled on wires from a clothesline-style conveyor, drawn over the flames of a giant brass furnace, where a small, fat man with no shirt operated a bellows by jumping on it. Tubes hung from the ceiling with spigots on their ends to dispense coffee. An indeterminate number of kittens playfully tore across the floor and climbed up curtains. Flamenco dancers marched through the aisles, shaking maracas. When BTB walked in and his gold lit up the place, all conversation stopped. Waiters dropped their serving trays. There was a momentous silence, solid enough to stop a bus dead in its tracks. Finally, with a creatinous roar, everyone rushed to embrace him. An army of old friends carried him off, leaving me and the mango alone. But not for long. A figure covered head to foot in silver wrapping paper led me to my present location, where four women in neon-colored kimonos took my order, hastily scribbling down the chemical formula. Only seconds later, the food was dispatched. Without hesitation, a long tube extended from the death mango into a vat of English muffins, clams, and bananas, emitting mechanical pumping and slurping sounds and spilling a great deal of it on the floor. In front of me, covering a very large portion of the wall, was the projected image of a face, sharp and twisted with age, drooping white Joseph Stalin mustache and painful Samuel Beckett eyes. His gravelly voice rumbled with a timbre so low I could feel it in my bones, made me uneasy. But now, someone dressed as a tall red minotaur has ambled on stage and looks like he is about to deliver a monologue.
Enora throws the pipe on the floor with a resonating ping. I stare out at the parking lot and sigh. Offer her a cigarette, which she eats pensively. It is a dance floor, four green walls and a window, nails in the floorboards for discipline. She struggles with a box of napkins which bursts open. Frustrated, she tells me to try the door again. Still, it is locked. Benoit's hands are shaking, spilling the contents of his drink. There are eight chairs, two of which match. Enora rips her poetry to shreds. Where have I been? She sobs. The other night, having gone through the bottomless coffee cup 6 times, she thought her material was significant. Benoit's rusty chair collapses, waking him up. Simultaneously, we look at the clock. Someone has to break down the door. Rummaging around in the crates, I find a fire axe. Enora carefully arranges the toast and jalapeno jelly. Benoit finds a box of crackers in the closet. Stepping over splintered chunks of door, I go out into the hall. No one is waiting to get in. Oh my gosh, Benoit jumps up. I forgot to put out the banner. Hanging out the window, he ties a flamboyant flag to the fire escape. An aged woman creeps in, forgetting to put money in the slot. She is followed by a big, self-conscious man in a black sweater. A brilliant scientist climbs in through the window and heads straight for the food table, picking up a beef log and a hunk of brie cheese.
BTB is now on stage about to perform his famous Bite the Bun theme song.
Glad to be here tonight. How are you all?
Alright.
When my friend asked me what I like to eat, I said buns. Yes, they're a special treat. When they're fresh from the oven, all crispy and sweet, those chewy blobs of molded wheat. But the big brown ones are especially fun, with the salt crystals that glisten in the sun. And a taste that stuns, I can't eat just one. Wrap my fingers around and I bite the bun. You know what I'm talking about. In all shapes and sizes with lots of seeds, with onion, caraway, and sesame, I go to the bakery with a special greed. I get them all, that's what I need. My tongue juices water and I start to lust for teeth to penetrate the crunchy crust. That's a fresh baked smell makes my insides bust. The sky gets dark and the wind starts to gust. That's what the bun will do to you. I'm not kidding. I bite down hard, can't wait no more. The chewy is tender, I just adore. Flakes of flavor and taste galore. Soon I'm running back to the store. Bite the bun, that's what I do. It'll solve all your problems. Yes, that's true. Big and brown, it's not something new. I'm talking about the bun, you get my clue? Yeah, pass me one of those big juicy buns right over here. No, I don't want no French bread. I want a bun. Yeah. They're real healthy for you, you know. They got lots of carbohydrates. Uh-huh, that's true. Eat those buns every day now. Thank you, thank you. Yeah, glad you liked it. Yo, yo, yo. See you all later.
That's the end of side two. Now here's some stuff to fill up the rest of this tape. Hi, Greg.
Thank you.
August 12th. I'm sitting now in my hotel room, which hangs by a cable over a bowl-shaped garden. Last night, the top of my head opened up, and my brain ran around the hall, yelping. A distinguished representative of the city's treasury presented me with a slab of gold the size of a briefcase. "What's this for?" I asked.
"All citizens of Nome Arnum are given a complimentary grant for the production of art,"
he said. "But I'm not a citizen."
"I pulled a few strings for you, cuz. Now you can have a necklace like mine,"
BTB said confidingly. In a flurry of bows, the treasury man left. I didn't have a safe handy, so I gave the slab to my trusty vehicle and instructed it to put this where no one can get it. The instant I said that, I realized I'd made a mistake, but it was too late. The mango was already out, searching for the most dangerous, most remote place to put the gold. In the morning, it returned, its skin scratched and scorched, leaving a trail of bolts and springs. The floating sphere extended a television screen on a telescopic boom to show its documentation of the mission. Across a vast sea of molten rock, with splashing waves of flaming lava, through swamps with slimy monsters, over deserts with roaming skeleton creatures, and finally into the palace of hell itself, the Death Mango traveled to deposit its cargo. Its final resting place is now at the bottom of a lake of tar, which, apparently, serves as a watering hole for Satan's snakes. "Yes, you certainly put it where no one could get it," I said. The mango chirped happily and swelled with pride, knowing it had performed its duty well. Here at the Cranston Marble Tracks, we are placing bets on which marble will reach the finish line first. Marbles roll down long, narrow troughs, slinking around trees, urns, boulders, and fountains in a vast Victorian garden. There are literally thousands of ways for them to go. BTB's real intention for coming here, though, is to be near the alluring woman he has been pursuing all day. I would join him in tailing voluptuous vipers, but I've been preoccupied with thoughts of the man, whose image is everywhere, in statues, paintings, banners, magazine covers, and posable action figures. Even as a crude likeness carved from marble, his presence is commanding. It's not unusual for someone to stop breathing in awe at his tremendous air of confidence and charisma. Audaciously clenching his characteristic cigarette holder in his teeth, his courageous gaze focused far away where his mind is already reckoning the next wondrous project he's going to build. He's never looking down at ground clutter, snags, briars, but up to the horizon, the point of convergence of his highways, to the clouds pierced by his slender towers, to the radiant vista of his amazing engineered skyline. It was next to the Scourge Cove Fountain that I had these thoughts. I scarcely noticed the monolithic structure, 50 stories high, with its web of pipes squirting cascades of water into dishes, rotating enormous, carefully balanced chunks of stone, emanating baritone grinding sounds. It took 50 years to construct, 49 years, 364 days for the builder to meditate atop a stack of materials, and one night to put it all together. BTB returned, and I asked him how it went with the comely woman.
"Well, I wanted this girl so much, a briefcase full of money crystallized in my hands out of thin air for me to give to her. I said, 'Run away with me, baby. We can roam the roads together.' But she asked if she could bring her marmoset along. I said, 'No way. I draw the line at marmosets.' Ooh, is that a reflection of me over there? I better not look or I'll fall in love with myself again."
A cloud passed under the sun, and a cold wind started to blow. Involuntarily, we turned around to see Big B Bigby lounging on a stone pedestal, which wasn't there before. His lanky figure was cloaked in green satin coveralls and an aluminum conical hat with big tassels that sparked and smoked. His long tongue lolled in a jar of peanut butter, scooped up a heaping tongueful, and returned to his mouth. He smacked his lips and sucked the gooey paste from his fingers in an evil way. Glaring scornfully at BTB, he said,
"So you're back from Fucktown, eh? Enjoy your stay?"
He sucked the residue on his fingers slowly.
"It's too bad you didn't stay. What's your name? Bathe the beagle? Bake the batfish? Borrow the brain cell? Whatever it is, you better keep quiet or you'll be going for another ride in one of my helicopters. I know how much you like that."
BTB returned.
"Yeah? Well, you got less cool than a mule. You've been eating so much peanut butter, your relays are starting to stick."
Big B laughed so fiercely, we were afraid he was going to break something. Actually, as it turned out, he was only choking on peanut butter. Later. To cheer ourselves up, we went to The Tank, a cafe inside a globe suspended in a huge tank of seawater. To get in, you have to put on a diving suit and swim to an airlock. Inside, through all the glass, you can see whales, giant squid, and tropical fish swimming around. You would expect the cuisine to be seafood, but in fact, it's strictly Mexican. BTB gave me the scoop on Big B. He's a very rich artist who uses his wealth cruelly, buying up the work of legitimate artists to vandalize and mangle, finally putting them up as works of his own. In a restaurant, he once ordered a coconut coffee cake in the shape of a squirrel served on the hood of a tractor driven by a goat herd, offering $50,000 if they could do it in 3 hours. They missed the deadline by half a minute, so he claims, though someone later pointed out that his watch doesn't work. He bought the place and tore it down, but this is when he's in a beneficent mood. He hates the man and will stop at nothing to ruin him. Months ago, when he was working as a pie delivery boy, BTB had an order for 20 peanut butter pies to be sent up to Big B's office. Having miraculously survived the trip up 50 floors on a rusted spiral staircase with rungs missing, he was about to knock on the door of Big B's decrepit office when he paused to listen. Oh, and by the way, inexplicably, despite his wealth, Big B seems to prefer horrible building standards over nice ones.
Yeah, that's right. I don't know why.
Inside,
that is.
Big B was discussing his plans for crimes against the man with his cronies. When his eavesdropping was discovered, it was all over for BTB. He was dropped from a helicopter into Fucktown, one of Big B's creations, presumed never to return.
Big B is bad, 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 bad,
BTB emphasized.
You don't want to have anything to do with him, because he'll ruinate your life.
Ah, our food has just arrived. You have the enchilada soup, right?
That's right.
Here, I have the cactus burrito.
All right, man.
We're running for our lives. Back at the tank, some guys behind us. Big B's men, I guess, from the smell of the peanut butter on their breath.
Oh, no!
They're bragging about the bomb they just planted
on
the Fantastico Bridge. BTB jumped up and shouted, "What?" That was it, boy. Everybody in the place started snarling and reaching in their pockets, and we were out of there so fast. I forgot to let go of the doorknob. We didn't even bother to put on pressure suits. Just swam right on out through the damp, spider-filled catacombs beneath the city, with which BTB is well acquainted from his delivery days. We made our way back to the gleaming offices of the man. At the far end of the cavernous room between gargantuan columns and full-grown redwood trees was the desk of his personal secretary. She informed us that he'd taken the week off to work in his secret laboratory. All she'd say about his location was that it was somewhere in the tepuis of Joe to the south. We were trying to get to the Death Mango now, on the other side of the city. We were almost gunned down by some guy on a motorcycle with two Uzis in his each hand. But we drove down a grating just in time. They're hunting us down, trying to kill us. This could very well be the last. August 14th. I've been lying unconscious on a cement floor, soaking wet, along with BTB and the kaput Death Mango for an indeterminate amount of time. I appear to be in some sort of engine room. In front of us, there are bags of food from a fast food restaurant. Here's the story so far. Somehow, we slipped out of Numar Num just as it was beginning to seem like everyone was bent on killing us. The dark of night and skillful maneuvering of our superb vehicle were responsible for our escape. It was early dawn when we reached the tepuis. Thousands of stone pillars rose high above a rainforest canopy, enveloped in a miasma of fog and drizzle. It stretched across a region the size of Venezuela. Plunging right in without a plan, we skimmed the treetops between mountainous rock towers, and soon we were completely lost. A whole day was wasted this way. When evening fell, BTB said,
"It's no use, Scroove, Captain. You can't find nothing in this place. Let's give up and go."
I reminded him that he could never return safely to Numar Num, his home, if we didn't find some way to stop Big B. Only someone as self-reliant and transcending as the man could help us. But there was more to it than fear for our own safety. By now, I had joined the thousands of admirers for the man. His work was honest, selfless, just. The picture of his smiling face, which I kept in my wallet, revealed the slightest trace of a furrowed brow, as though his labors were not without pain and hardship. This fueled my resolve to help, to find and help the man. We were about to set down on top of a tepuy for the night when the mango produced a slot and said, "Please insert food, unable to proceed without edible material." I routinely reached into the food bag, but found it empty. I turned all the coffers and boxes inside out, but there wasn't so much as a stump of carrot to give the mango. I explained this, but its reasoning was blurred by hunger. In a frenzy, it raced around searching for food. Finally, it passed out, and we all plummeted through the canopy, crashing on the spongy bottom. Rendered blind by columns of steam rising from the jungle floor, we stumbled around for hours, unable to locate the mango.
A faint voice pierced the mist.
Food! Food! Food!
Leading us to the pitiful sphere, we rolled it to a fortunately placed river with the intention of using it as a boat and rowing to a town. This river could scarcely be called anything but a catastrophic torrent. The hundreds of waterfalls we saw cascading from the plateaus must all wind up in one place, and we were unfortunate enough to be in it. It started off innocent enough, but in a few minutes we were crashing down a 45-degree slope through knife-like boulders jutting up and cliffs on either side hemming us in. The Mango, although it floated like a big beach ball, was a terrible boat. We had to swim in the frigid foam with nothing to grasp onto. Poor BTB had 50 pounds of gold to weigh him down, but he refused to part with it. As I was passing out, I thought I saw a boat of terrific size with lots of oars. Apparently, we'd been plucked out of our graves by someone or something aboard the trireme, which is where I am now. Yes, it's the same trireme that I saw from the Lambda Expressway. I'm sure of that. Looking around, this is what I see. Creaking wooden gears lashed together with fraying rotten cables, shafts of steel spinning, smoking, screaming in crankcases empty of oil, tolerances mismatched, poor fittings, parts made so big they slam into each other, colossal transformers swollen with current, rattling dishes in the sink, capacitors so vast the magnets cower, gauges, switches, knobs without labeling cramming stainless steel walls, banks of hot glowing vacuum tubes, rusted iron cages, rubber insulation bubbling on overloaded wires, coolant pipes leaking, the drops striking super hot surfaces and exploding in puffs of steam, circuit boards dangling from the ceiling, relays the size of cabbages clicking loudly, sparks from their terminals lighting the walls with staccato flashes, a piece of scrap metal connected to a piston scraping back and forth on the cement floor, screeching, pointless, a chain-driven pulley hoisting up a bucket full of rocks, dropping them on glass insulators and shattering them, sparks jumping across gaps, open flames on gas jets dangerously close to the wooden fuel tank. Although not UL listed, this apparatus somehow manages to keep the three-tiered vessel rowing down the river. We found someone aboard the ship, a crazy old sea captain who calls himself Vasco da Gama and who claims to have found the first trade route to India by sea. Here's how we ran into him. A while ago, BTB was helping himself to the contents of a meat locker while I was observing the machinery of the place. I happened to wander into a recreation room of some sort, with exercise equipment, drafting tools, synthesizers from Sam's Soul Food, I should note, lots of toys, and a man lying on the floor in a puddle of dark red fluid. Rushing to his side, I prepared to administer medical treatment, but his eyes opened. His fierce stare threw me back in surprise. He leapt to his feet with briskness unusual for someone of his apparent age and began dusting himself off. I noticed a sheet of paper stuck to his back and I pulled it off. Is this yours? I asked.
Oh my gosh, yes. My best watercolor painting yet. It would be a vastly better if I hadn't slept on it, but you know what happens when you've been up for 12 days.
He launched into a description of his painting, a bowl of telescopes. By then it was clear that the reddish liquid was not blood, but paint, which he had spilled in the same manner as he was doing again, pacing the room, kicking paint bottles obliviously. He didn't seem to wonder about my identity, and even took my presence for granted, as though I were a member of his crew. Perhaps I fit an archetype for young naval men who served aboard ships of his past. A jumble of questions reached my tongue at once, but I couldn't decide the proper order in which to ask them. He rode an exercise bike and reminisced about a canning factory and a river of mud, among other things. He was full of zany stories too insane to be fiction and too far-fetched to have happened. I regret not getting them on tape, but these ramblings about ancient highway systems, ruins of delicatessens, and roadside picnic spots he had explored, but that just serves to illustrate the extent to which his audience was captivated. His control of the ship was as precarious and haphazard as the engine that propelled it. He would recklessly smear his hand all over a bank of switches and achieve whatever effect he desired, puffing his pipe and staring into space. Watching him, it was certain that he didn't have the slightest idea what he was doing, but things happened to work out.
How do you run this ship?
BTB asked.
Where's the instruction book for this thing?
I don't know. I think I threw it out. Why do you ask me so many questions? I'm a great explorer.
Ripping off a printout, he would pretend to study it intently, nodding to himself as though he'd gleaned some important details from it. Then he would use it to line the cat box. He's watching cartoons now. As soon as he's finished, I'm going to overcome my shyness and confront him with our dilemma. Does he know of the man? Surely someone as well-traveled as he and an architect as eminent as the man have to have at least remote acquaintance with each other. Mr. Da Gama, sir, have you ever heard of somebody called the man?
Oh, sure. I deliver his newspapers to him.
Wow, that's great. Where can we find him?
The secret laboratory you want to find? You want to know where it is? Okay, I'll tell you how to get there from here. Go down to the river until you come to a lake. Then turn around because you've gone too far. Soon the bank will get really sandy. We'll stop there and have some lunch. We'll look around for some nice rocks and maybe get in some fishing. Then go into the woods on the right and find a good-sized stick. Throw it into the air and watch where it comes down. The direction in which it points is where you should go. After a few hours of tramping through swamps and thorn bushes, you will see a white plateau. Climb up of this and have a good look around. You'll see a road in the valley below. Follow this road east until you come to a bridge. Dive into the river and swim upstream a few miles until it starts to get really cold. Get out and run around for a while until you're dry. When you look up, you'll see that you're right where you want to be.
At the men's secret laboratory?
No, at the ice cream factory. Isn't that where you wanted to go? Oh no, look at the time. I have to let in to the fish. Can't leave them out too long. They've been declawed and can't defend themselves.
Okay, so he's a lunatic. Less stable than a brick balanced on a needle. He could keep a team of psychiatrists working around the clock for decades. If he knew how to get to the man, we weren't going to get it out of him. We left the madman to his inscrutable chores, and now we're speeding down the river in the hopes that we'll find somebody to whom the man is not a mystery. Now let me tell you about something interesting that happened just now. BTB wanted a tropical shake, so he put some of the apricots and watermelons we found aboard the trireme into the shake-o-matic and flicked on the switch. Immediately followed by an inhuman scream, opened up the blender and a cat jumped out. By now it was too late to turn back to return the cat to Vasco da Gama, not that she would be safe with a lunatic in a motorboat, so he decided to adopt her as a pet. She's a very strange animal. When you try to pet or cuddle her, she growls and hisses. But when you abuse her, step on her tail or something, she purrs. We generally leave her alone now. She keeps herself occupied by reading technical manuals for the death mango. After being completely lost for several hours, we found a treacherous road that loops around peaks like spaghetti on a fork. Mountains so tall they freshen your breath, as the mitochondrion would say. Right now, there's a very sleek car behind us gaining speed.
Ooh, that looks like an Oku Research 255 Regulus Roadster to me, with a particle accelerator engine. And it has a 20-pound gyroscope for a hood ornament. Wow!
The windows are blackened, so we can't make out who it is, but it's pulling up alongside the mango. The roof is sliding open, and a man in a jumbo, floppy red Panama hat and matching hip waders is rising up.
Oh my god, that's Bigby! Let's get out of here!
Bigby is standing, legs wide apart, holding up the fattest pistol I've ever seen, essentially a sawed-off cannon. And he's firing! Whoa, any normal man would have had his head sheared off by the recoil, but this man is evil. Fortunately, evil may be strong, but it has terrible aim. The cannonball missed my head by about an inch and struck a rock outcropping, spraying us with gravel.
Never mind that! Think of something that will get rid of this guy! Oh no, look out!
All is lost. The mango moved like never before, in a car chase so intense the road dissolved and snakes migrated north. We were badly outmatched, and after a valiant effort, the mango was overheating. Finally, it shattered, like a punch bowl dropped from a tree, sending us rolling painfully to a stop on the hard obsidian lane. Big B sped off, laughing, through a megaphone. We sat among the steaming pieces of mango and cried. The cat, whose paw contained a jackknife with dozens of tools that popped out when she needed them, built a steam car out of stones and roadside garbage. She scooped up the parts of the mango, each no bigger than a cubic inch, and placed them in a brown paper bag. Then she started up the car and drove off. The moment was saturated with sadness. BTB played harmonica as I sang an old binary song about a venerable computer whom everyone loved, but which died of obsolescence and lack of spare parts. It went something like, 01101010101101101101101101101101101101101101101101101101101101101101101101101101101101101101101101101101101101101101101101101101101101101101101101101101101101101101101101101101101101101101101101101101101101101101101101101101101101101101101101101101101101101101101101101101101101101101101101101101101101101101101101101101101101101101101101101101101101101101101101101101101101101101101101101101101101101101101101101101101101101101101101101101101101101101101101101101101101101101101101101101101101101101101101101101101101101101101101101101101101101101101101101101101101101101101101101101101101101101101101101101101101101101101101101101101101101101101101101101101101101101101101101101101101101101101101101101101101101101101101101101101101101101101101101101101101101101101101101101101101101101101101101101101101101101101101101101101101101101101101101101101101101101101101101101101101101101101101101101101101101101101101101101101101101101101101101101101101101101101101101101101101101101101101101101101101101101101101101101101101101101101101101101101101101101101101101101101101101101101101101101101101101101101101101101101101101101101101101101101101101101101
from any civilization. BTB described the situation best when he said,
"This is not cool."
As
As we were wallowing in the
depths of misery, a truck coming down the road caught my eye. It was a colossal truck with about 50 wheels and big smokestacks billowing pitch black clouds of smoke. I seem to recall having encountered it someplace before. It slowed to a stop, and I read the faded lettering on its side. Vanadium Van. This was the guy I saw at the fuel market. The cab door popped open, and out jumped a slim guy in a trench coat and wide-brimmed fedora. He stood before us, smiling boldly, teeth clenching a long cigarette holder. The curl tube of my brain unraveled and squeaked like one of those cheesy noisemakers you see at parties. It was the man. I leapt to my feet and cried tears of joy. We tried to explain to him about Big B's scheme to scuttle the Fantastico Bridge, but he held up his hand and nodded sagaciously.
Yes, I know all about it. Hop on board my van.
He engaged the massive motors, revving them up to high RPM, then threw in the highest gear, causing the truck to lurch forward at full speed with instant acceleration. He careened through an intricate system of byways and off-road trails which no one knew better than he. Number 9, his lovely dog, sniffed delicately at our trouser cuffs and resumed reading today's newspaper, which had been drying on the floor. The man spoke.
I've been trying to make this region a vibrant network of cities, calibrated, harmonious, and beautiful, accountable to the needs of people and nature. For myself, I want only to see my creations make them happy, the people I love. But Big B wants to thwart all that. When this territory was first surveyed, there was nothing but a string of molybdenum mines that had gone dry years earlier. Big B won them in a chess match, and he thought he was bilking me when he sold me the title. I started with nothing but a backhoe and some issues of Workbench magazine, working from dawn to dusk, and sometimes dawn to dawn, moving boulders, quarrying obsidian, shaping the land with naught but my own hands. But the Lambda Expressway came to life. Slowly, painfully, kicking and screaming the whole way. I recruited some courageous workers and things developed faster until the Lambda Engineering Company was formed. I had the delight of seeing a city grow from pebbles and sand. Big B, that diabolical genius, realized early on the mistake he'd made. He formed his own architectural firm and began competing directly with us. His work was shoddy and incompetent, culminating in horrors like Fucktown. But he kept up a good pace, forcing me to work faster and push my men harder. We move on the edge of exhaustion because there is so much at stake. If we relent, Big B will transform the land into a sprawling ugliness full of decaying tenement buildings and dirty factories. Big B has always resorted to unscrupulous and devious means of making a profit. He would bamboozle his customers by using inferior materials and implanting flaws calculated to require expensive repairs. But he couldn't compete with a respectable architect, and his business soon collapsed. In Num Ar Num, my prototypical Wunderberg, he built his last building, a monstrous structure known to drop pieces of masonry onto the streets from time to time, and moved in. Immediately, he set himself to the task of ruining me. This latest piece of sabotage is but one incident in a long past of such crimes. For years, his criminal cronies have been infecting my company, sabotaging equipment, rerouting supplies, causing me to miss deadlines, and even compromising the quality of the end product. The faith of my customers is strong but brittle. At any moment, I could lose their trust and loyalty completely. Fantastico Bridge is Big B's last gambit.
We arrived at the phenomenal Fantastico Bridge, which appeared as solid and permanent as a mountain. It was hard to imagine anything dangerous enough even to blemish it.
Did you happen to overhear where the bomb was placed?
The 9,000th supporting strut, we told him. It's too bad the scofflaws weren't there to be complimented for their sheer stupidity in bragging about the bomb's exact location. The man dove over the edge of the Vando discontinuity and caught a girder beneath the bridge. Then, grasping bars of the understructure and moving hand over hand, he traveled for nearly a mile until he reached the hotspot. With his bare hands, he tightened bolts loosened to weaken the structure, and severed beams were repaired with his pocket arc welder. Finally, he carefully removed the detonation caps from the explosive device and put it in his shirt pocket. Hardly grimacing, he hurled himself upward, spun in midair, and landed perfectly on the bridge surface.
How are you going to send this sucker to jail?
BTB asked.
He always signs his handiwork. It's the artist in him.
To celebrate, we went for the Golden Sandwich, the man's favorite place for lunch. There, food was meant to be seen, but not eaten. Servants brought sculptured marble, painted plaster, and beaten copper simulations of food to the patrons, who examined them with great concentration and then had them taken away to be smashed to pieces. Big B was there, but he didn't notice us. The man summoned a waiter and whispered something into his ear while placing money in his hand. The waiter went over to Big B and said, "Excuse me, sir, this is from the gentleman at that table." With that, he punched Big B in the gut, and causing him to double over with pain. When he came to, Big B looked white as a picket fence. He staggered out of the restaurant and hauled off in his reckless roadster.
"That'll keep him out of my hair for a while,"
said the man, blowing the perfect cube of smoke before resuming his contemplation of a sandstone turkey leg. Suddenly, there was a lot of commotion outside, and I looked to see a black blur racing in circles, chasing crowds of people in the street.
The death mango crashed through the window and hovered obediently by the table. An access plate opened, and out fell the cat and the box of tools. The cat made one last check with a logic probe, then closed the panel and scurried off to order herself a basket of fish. Presently, we are following the vanadium van en route to the man's secret laboratory. We've just been given a tour of the mysterious retreat of the man, miles beneath the Earth's surface. Music by Brian Eno and Robert Fripp and tasteful lighting invoke a pleasant atmosphere for working. Mice with hard hats and clipboards scamper through the place, chattering urgently and disappearing down tiny holes. Every wall is a chalkboard, filled with equations and computations so hellishly complicated it gives you vertigo. Dozens of mainframes lie about the place, but he regards them as toys and rarely uses them except to play games. In a contest for speed of calculation, he always wins. Scattered around the domicile are thousands of blueprints, cups of half-drunken coffee, vending machines for candy, pool tables, trade journals, unfinished chess, shogi, and go games, and a miniature city of model buildings covering most of the floor space. BTB, clearly jealous, asked the man,
"Yo, how'd you get to be so great?"
The man smiled and said,
"The only difference between you and me is that I built my own backhoe."
Thanks to Steve Nove, Mopar Car Dealerships, Walbridge Soups and Trout Supplies, and Sonic, Gernon Loan Sharking Limited, Weiss Mandate Enforcement Services, Brothers Elton and Ed of the Monastery Beneath the Sea, Delvo's Poisonous Snack Catering, Teak, Officer Miriam of the Insanity Patrol, Realistic, only as a last resort, JM and the folks at 460, Puffy's Reality Debugging Crew, Travis's Protozoa Warehouse, Cassio, Muckenhub's Hyperbolic Hut, Fostex, Zen Master Ozdoba, Curran Misinformation and Threat Supplies, Apple Computers, Grigby's Evil Plan Leasing, John Armstrong, Manager of Curses R Us. The Lambda Expressway is a Falling Cat presentation, written by Eric Ray with conceptual assistance by Elton Ray, Chris Gernon, and Greg Mitochondrian Travis, recorded at Gunpoint Studio. Copyright 1991 by Enrico Rattleboni.